Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 11th of September, 2025. It is 9:30, and we welcome you to the roundtable panel. Thanks to Ray and Sarah for their great work working the lockbox this morning. They'll be back throughout the program to remind you of the importance of what we're doing on this day. As Ray mentioned, a somber day for several reasons. We'll talk about those during the course of our panel discussion this morning. But we want to make the case to you that having a conversation and civil discourse is something we do every day on this program, and that we give all the opportunity to come in and to talk and to discuss these issues, and that we want to support a radio station that allows that and let that to continue to happen. We hope you'll help us with the lockbox, WAMC.org. In the meantime, we'll spend our moments together working on the panel and talking about what working with the panel and talking about the issues of the day. And I want to introduce our group to you, and then we'll get started with the news. We begin with Malia Dumont, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. And I bring greetings from Ambassador Fred Hoff. I saw him in Jerusalem last week.
Oh, great. He actually wrote me from Jerusalem. It was odd. He was like, oh, I asked him a petty question, and he said, well, yes, I can't answer right now because I'm in Jerusalem. But that's very good. He's doing well, and mm-hmm. That's where you all hang out in the off days.
No, yeah. I'm sure we'll get to it during the panel, but we each had professional reasons to be there. And some of those reasons include what you were just talking about. You know, we have to talk with all different kinds of people who might be able to help us come together and get things done for the greater good. So that's the very broad headline about why each of us were there.
Well, thank you, and it's good to have you here. I appreciate it very much. We also welcome Grants Analyst based in Albany, Emily Honan, who is here. Good morning, Emily. How are you?
Good morning. I'm a little overwhelmed, as per the norm these days.
Yes, a lot going on, a lot to keep track of, a lot to put into perspective, and that's what we'll try to help with this morning. Judy Patrick is with us, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. It's nice to be here on this kind of beautiful day, which reminds me of that beautiful day.
24 years ago.
Yeah, it was the same kind of bright blue sky. Eerie reminder there.
It certainly is. And as I said, we'll be talking about 9/11. A little bit later on in the program. Of course, the headline of the morning is the manhunt that is underway for the person who killed Charlie Kirk, the charismatic founder of the nation's preeminent right-wing youth activist group, in a brazen attack on a Utah college campus. No suspects were in custody as of this morning. And Mr. Kirk, a close ally of President Trump and the founder of a prominent conservative youth activist group, was shot while speaking to students at Utah Valley University. The FBI released the man its director had said was the subject of investigation. They actually had taken two people into custody that were labeled as a person of interest. And both were interviewed and then subsequently released a short time later. Meanwhile, just while we were, while the lockbox was going on in the last 10, 15 minutes or so, 9, 10 minutes, there was a press conference that happened in Salt Lake City. And officials say they have recovered the gun that they believe was used in the shooting of Charlie Kirk. Robert Bowles is the special agent in charge of the FBI's Salt Lake City field office. He described it in a news conference as a high-powered bolt-action rifle. It was found in a wooded area where the shooter fled to after killing Kirk. Investigators also said during this press conference that they have good video footage of this individual. Bo Mason, who is Utah's public safety chief, says that officials will not release it while they are working to identify the suspect through facial recognition technology. If they are unsuccessful, he said, they plan to share his image publicly in an effort to identify him. He has been referring to the shooter as a man throughout the news conference, although no other information was given. Investigators have other evidence that could help them identify and track down the killer. The special agent said that evidence includes a palm imprint, a forearm imprint, and a footwear impression. Meanwhile, the suspect in the shooting appears to be of college age, and they say we are confident in our abilities to track that individual. This again from Bo Mason, the commissioner of Utah's Department of Public Safety, and saying that investigators have been able to identify the gunman in video footage taken yesterday. There was a comment made earlier yesterday during, I believe, the first press conference where they said they had surveillance footage, which was not of great quality. And since then, going through the neighborhoods, once the gunman was fleeing the scene, they do have better footage that they are investigating as we speak. So that's the latest on that situation. That gives you an idea of how the manhunt is going. But obviously, there is the overall issue as well of what is being called, certainly by the governor of the state of Utah, as well as the president of the United States, as a political assassination. Malia.
It's hard to know where to begin with this. So it's not the first political assassination we've seen in this country this year. We had the assassination of the Minnesota lawmaker just in June. Charlie Kirk, I don't know a lot about him, but I understand that he had his own security in addition to the security that Utah Valley University, is that
yes,
the name?
Yeah.
Yes. Had on site. So clearly he knew that there were threats against him of some sort that perhaps were not that public. But there's so many facts about this that are really deeply troubling that someone was killed. It seems clear it's a political assassination. I mean, there shouldn't be any. I don't think there should be any argument about that. Who did it and why? We can speculate. But if it's a political assassination, then generally that means you're trying to silence the person who committed this crime. Was trying to silence a voice that they didn't agree with, or they found was dangerous in some way. And it's the fact that it happened on a university campus too is just in some ways I feel like it makes it worse. I mean, this is a place where you're supposed to be able to talk through differences, learn from each other. Bringing in someone as a speaker doesn't mean you agree with them. It means you're creating an opportunity for dialogue, and that, you know, as educators we never give up hope that dialogue is possible, that learning can take place through engagement and interaction. And it's so antithetical to everything that a university stands for someone of college age who may have been a student there or nearby to commit a crime like this, silence a voice in public like that. I mean, it's terrible on a number of levels, and that breaks my heart. And then also I'm concerned about, you know, what happens next. What are the what are the reactions to this going to be? We've already seen some of the reactions in Congress and from the president. And I think it was the Utah governor who said in his speech, among other things, reach out and hug someone. So there's a full spectrum of different kinds of reactions. But to have two political assassinations take place just within a couple of months in this country, it's obviously doesn't speak well to the state of our polity. But I personally, how do I react to this aside from being heartbroken over it? I think it's important for us to continue to find positive ways to go forward. I feel even more like a stronger conviction about the importance of my own work as an educator, trying to bring people together. We can't throw in the towel and say, now it's a free for all woe is us. I think it's really important that we not give up the principles that we hold for, peaceful civic engagement, and just renew our commitment to that.
One of the things that struck me about this, about Charlie Kirk is, and I certainly knew of him. I knew of his popularity. I knew that he was a major force on college campuses. The fact that what happened yesterday was if someone who is on campus and is taking questions from people who don't necessarily agree with him, and there is a debate, and it is a healthy debate. Is it a show? Sure, it is. I mean, that's what it is, right? You come in and he's a podcaster, he is an influencer, but it is an opportunity for people to say what's on their mind and for him to respond. If that doesn't happen on a college campus, then where in the hell can it happen?
Right.
I actually am very familiar with Charlie Kirk. I've been following him for many, many years.
You were of that vintage.
I am. I'd like to first share a quote from my friend, which I think was my friend who's a trans man who lives in Florida. And I think it's a very good quote. Well, it's just kind of a feeling. They said, political violence right now, I think, is a little too much on both sides. I don't want this to be the norm. I don't want to live in a country where this is the norm. And then he said, I don't want to live in this country for many reasons, but I don't really want to live in this country where political violence is a norm. I would like also to share a quote from Charlie Kirk from directly after the Minneapolis school shooting. I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it to have a cost of, unfortunately, some gun deaths every single year so we can have the Second Amendment to protect our God-given right.
And it's that makes this all so murky, right? That we are trying to, look, I think we're all on the same page. No one deserves to be assassinated. No one deserves to be gunned down for their thoughts and what they say. If people do not agree with them, but I and that fact is just to me, something that is troubling because we seem to be losing that, and both sides are do amp up the rhetoric. I don't know what the solution to that is, other than when something like this happens, you always think it's the opportunity that we can address it, and that never works out.
Yeah, in some respects, I've seen a lot of comments from the left, pulling up all of the kind of hateful things that Charlie Kirk said, and then talk about all the other bad things that happened yesterday. There was a school shooting. But you can't underestimate the importance of Charlie Kirk to young conservatives, to the Donald Trump presidency, to how he motivated people. And I don't see any need to make him a hero. I don't seem, but I think the moment for us now is to discuss political violence and how wrong it is. Imagine all of, like, I think there were 3,000 people in that audience yesterday.
Yes.
All of those people underwent that kind of trauma. And now, with that video that millions of people have seen, I mean, the videos from that are horrific. I would encourage people to take their time and let the news develop. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't jump on the fray of, you know, this is a truly human tragedy for Charlie Kirk and his family and all the people who loved and, you know, admired him, but also for us as a nation, because we are going to a very bad place. What we need is for every one of us to acknowledge that this is wrong, that people should be able to speak their mind, to engage in debate, even if what they are saying is horrific, is something we really do not agree with. But let them talk and let them. I mean, I think one of the things Kirk did was try to debate people. He was really good at it, and he always won each debate. I mean, every back and forth, I've seen him slap down people with, you know, sometimes wrong logic. But he was an important part of the Trump administration and what's happening. I think discussing where that movement goes from now is going to be interesting, because there's nobody like him.
31 years old.
Yeah.
Two young children, a wife. And that just gives it a human element, that he's not a monster. He's not someone whose head spins around. He is a real person who goes to parks and goes to ball games and brings his kids to school in the morning, and while, again, as Judy just said, is for people who do not certainly find what he is saying disagreeable, there is a way to counter that and a way to, as I said, and to have a forum in a college. It just strikes me as the place that those conversations should happen.
I think that what a lot of people also have been saying is that this is a symptom of the rhetoric that's been preached in this country for the past year. And it's frightening to see that, you know, it can come back and do this to people who even spoke about this as if it was something that should be expected in the country. And it shouldn't be. You know, people shouldn't have to sink to these lows to make waves, to make changes. This shouldn't be the norm, but unfortunately for many people, it almost is. I mean, you just mentioned that we had the assassination of Melissa Hortman and her husband in her home, you know, not even 2 months ago. That hasn't even settled. I feel like with the news cycle these days, these things just keep going and going and going. It gets replaced by some other tragedy. You know, I've seen people talking about, you know, how long is this going to last? How long until the next big tragedy happens, and everybody focuses on that, and this fades into the background. And I'm not sure. I don't know if this is going to prove to be something different from our what our news cycle has become. But it really is. It's frightening. It's frightening at its core. And what, like what my friend said, it's just sort of another sign of the country descending into something lower.
And we're going to take a break, but I mean, the one thing I did want to mention too is you both have mentioned those who were killed, but you know, you even look at the horrific Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who as his family was sleeping in the first night of Passover, someone went to the residence and set off two Molotov cocktails and threatened that entire family. And thank God nobody was hurt. But again, it is another example, further example of political violence. We'll take a break and we'll continue with this conversation. We welcome your letters. I haven't looked yet, but I assume there are a lot. And we will get to those. I promise we'll give everyone plenty of time to talk about
these issues as we move forward this morning. Don't forget our lockbox as well, as we keep this station very much grounded in the idea of having conversations and civil discourse. WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this 11th day of September, and we welcome you. We'll get to letters in a few moments. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Given your military background, Malia, I will ask you about this, but the weapon that was used, I mean, the one thing about this, the other aspect of it is, I mean, we can get into the security part of this too, which is that for the 3,000 students, there was no security check going in. People were not screened going in. It was an outdoor event, so that, of course, would have made it more difficult, but that was the case. And then also, of the officers who were in addition to Charlie Kirk's own security, which we don't know how many people yet that included, it was six people. And that's not very many people to be monitoring 3,000 people who are out there, especially with a gunman on a roof, allegedly, at this case. Tell me about the weapon, and also, if you can, just how every map I've looked at, that shot is really far away. I mean, that does tell us something about the person who's doing it, that it you would have to be trained to be able to pull that off.
Yes, but I don't think that's very unusual in Utah. So the weapon you mentioned is a bolt action rifle as opposed to a shotgun, for example.
Yes.
So a shotgun shoots pellets or shot and it sort of scatters, whereas bolt action shoots a round that, I mean, it's more, it's designed to kill or maim someone or something. I think Utah is one of the states where, I mean, it's an outdoor state. There's a lot of hunting. There's a lot of federal and state lands, and it's pretty common for people there to have weapons, have access to weapons, and so it doesn't necessarily surprise me that that a bolt action rifle was used. Clearly, the to pull this off, the person had to have planned this out. They knew enough about the event to know where they were going to have line of sight, to where the speaker was sitting. They had planned ahead of time, to find a place where they could have that line of sight and not be interrupted. Unlike in the movies where some assassin shows up and sets themselves up and they're in and out in 30 seconds, that's not what I would expect was the case here. They probably needed to, set themselves up and find the right moment. And then they knew what their escape route was going to be. So there was clearly a plan in place for all this. Sorry, what was your other question?
No, I guess it was about security.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how you keep a group secure, and
and
are we at a point, I mean, given the rise of political violence, and you touched on this earlier in your remarks, that he knew that there were threats against
right.
him, obviously, and yet this was the plan agreed on between his camp and the university,
right.
and they went forward with it. But I think any of us who have gone to, I've been security checked at book readings. So, like, you know what I mean? Like,
right, yeah. So it's a little bit, I mean, since he had his own security, I mean, ostensibly, I expect that if Charlie Kirk had wanted there or had insisted, I'm only going to do events where there are screenings, then the screenings would have been set up. And for whatever reason, it wasn't set up in this place. I'm not sure. I don't know if it's a capacity issue or not.
But screening wouldn't have helped.
It wouldn't have helped in this case.
And it's true that, you know, on most college campuses, and I don't know what the laws are in Utah, but in a lot of places, I mean, the security or the police on college campuses, I mean, it varies widely from, you know, large universities that have their own police forces, some of whom actually carry weapons, to smaller institutions that have, I mean, they're all very capable, well-trained people, but on a lot of campuses, the officers don't carry weapons, and they're there more for, crowd control and general safety and security, and to, you know, remove
drunk freshmen,
right? Things like that, and they're, I mean, most college campuses are not prepared to guard against assassin rifle bearers.
And I mean, obviously, I've been watching. I've been just bathing in cable news over the last 24 hours. But I mean, one of the points that I thought was made was that the president of the United States, arguably, has the greatest security force on the planet, which is that of the Secret Service, which I know has been maligned and questioned in recent time, and yet still was the subject of two. One where he was actually struck, and another where he was put in great danger. And still, even with that, those incidents were not able to be avoided. So, I mean, that is something to keep in mind, that I hate to say this, but like, if there's a will, there's a way, and if the will is there to harm and to or kill someone, then the possibility exists.
Well, if there's a will and a gun, there's a way.
I also thought last night about Salman Rushdie. I mean, Salman Rushdie on the stage of Chautauqua, and a man with a knife, leaping onto the stage and going after and damn near killing Salman Rushdie, as well as the interviewer who was speaking with him at that event, another event that was in an outdoor amphitheater.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a non sequitur, but just. Speaking of knives, I mean, so we have a gun violence issue in this country, obviously, but where in China, it's another example I know pretty well. Citizens can't own weapons, but they haven't had a problem with school shootings the way we've had, but they have had a number of school stabbings where people show up at schools and are. I mean, I don't want to get into the details, but it's there's trouble everywhere, and it's like steam cookers, and people are letting out the steam in really destructive ways in a lot of places.
We're going to take a break. We will return. We'll go over to our Lockbox studio with Ray and Sarah. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have been discussing the killing of Charlie Kirk on a campus in Utah University campus yesterday. The activist was fatally shot. The shooter still at large and unidentified. There is much speculation about what motivated the killing. And there was, within the last hour, a update in Utah as to the investigation, in which we learned that they have found the gun. They believe that was used in the killing. Also, they have some prints, both a forearm print, a palm print, and a footprint a footwear print that was taken. And they believe that the suspected gunman was of college age. Also, that they have additional video footage, which they are now investigating, and better footage than they had in trying to ascertain who this individual is. We have a lot of letters on this. I want to go to those and continue our conversation as we do it. And we thank you very much for, you know, being civil and all as we go through the letters. Here we go. I'm not talking to our panelists. I'm talking to the listeners. But I'm talking, you know, for all.
It's a good reminder for everybody.
Yes, exactly. William says, the thing that strikes me about this instance compares to the lawmaker getting killed earlier this year is how media is already calling this an assassination, while the previously mentioned killing is still mostly just called a killing. It's a point. I don't know.
I wasn't aware of that. Like in the media, like just comparing the number of headlines about each.
I don't know exactly how that's. And you know how it's defined and used and.
I think there's a lot of nitpicking going on, to be quite honest with you. I think, and I don't think it's useful because what you're seeing, well, you know, the president didn't have the flags lowered at half staff when the Minnesota lawmaker and her husband were killed. I mean, it's all true. But does that really advance our need to address this problem and come together as a nation? This is reminding me a little bit of the mid-60s when we had, you know, especially 1968, where you had, you know, all those assassinations. I mean, the term refers to the killing of a prominent person for political, for you know, it has to be an important person, and there, and the Minnesota lawmaker was important, especially in Minnesota, but. Charlie Kirk, across this nation, for a whole generation of young men, was very important. Is he more important? Every person's life is important. But I think drawing the comparisons to, well, the right isn't treating, you know, they're making more of this than they are of other horrific events, I think, again, may be true, but does it really help us heal as a nation?
I noticed a very, and you talk about nitpicking, but I thought... I was a little nitpicky last night. I noticed when I was putting the stories together and even just when I sent out the headlines that the New York Times kept on calling it a right-wing activist and the Washington Post referred to him as a conservative activist. Hmm. And I went with conservative because I think even with the right wing there were certainly issues in which Charlie Kirk disagreed with MAGA, disagreed with President Trump, and I don't know. There's just something with right wing and left wing that makes it seem more fringe than it does if it's. I mean, there's no denying that this person's ideology was conservative. That is nitpicking, but I do find it to be interesting. Let's go to another letter, and we go to Diane, who says, what is truly distressing is that no matter the political side, humanity seems to be put aside. I pray for our better angels to overtake the vitriol in so many hearts. That from Diane. A reminder, we welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org. Mary says, on Charlie Kirk, of course, we don't condone anyone being shot, let alone killed. Charlie Kirk has said that empathy is a sign of weakness. I actually do have empathy for his family, and I am not weak. I believe empathy is the opposite. It's a sign of strength. It's too bad he is being martyred. Thanks for your empathetic voices. And that is from Mary. We go to Alan. It is disingenuous to throw around both sides-ism. There is no evidence that Kirk was killed by a leftist, nor has there been any political violence by a leftist on the national stage, let alone mass shootings in general.
Are you going to go to another question? Or,
no.
I'm
going to go to Emily Honan.
I just wanted to bring up something very interesting. This is might be a little distressing for some people, but I did listen to the last question that Charlie Kirk answered before he was shot. Extremely on topic, which is kind of frightening in its own right. But he was answering the question. The person asked, "Do you know how many transgender shooters there have been in America in the past 10 years?" And he said, "Too many," to roaring applause. And the person answered, "Well, there's been 5. I'll give you credit. That is, an amount. Do you know how many mass shooters there have been in America over the past 10 years?" And he responded, "Counting or not counting gang violence." And then he was shot. So I just think that's an interesting kind of demonstration, because they I've seen a lot of sort of both sides-ism. And while I do agree that, yes, it is not a good thing on both sides, I do think it is disingenuous to act like it's kind of like a thing of equal magnitude when it just isn't. Also, as he said, we don't know what side the shooter was on. Trump's assassin was actually a right wing or conservative or whoever you wanna or would be assassin.
Yeah. Kevin writes, "Both sides are not ramping up the rhetoric. The rational, quote, side is slowly coming around to responding, albeit angrily. Enough with both sides." That from Kevin. We go to Vincent. "President Trump's words about political violence ring hollow in light of his pardon of January 6 rioters that resulted in numerous injuries and death. He also called them patriots." Then we go to Mike. "Any murder or assassination is horrible, but motive is also important. Hopefully time will help get this suspect caught to see exactly why this occurred. Speculation and misinformation cannot lead anywhere good." That is true. I did one of my initial thoughts yesterday after this happened is And this sounds like I'm picking on our journalistic colleagues.
Go ahead.
But I thought, I hope they catch this individual very, very quickly so that we don't have 3 days of them just spinning their wheels, coming up with possible scenarios and letting this spin out further and further and further.
Right. They're filling, this is particularly true on
cable news
when they're trying to fill the airtime. I mean, what we're seeing so far is, the initial reaction and then a lot of the police manhunt kind of a thing. I'm not seeing a lot of speculation about what the motive is or what the who the assailant might be. I think at this point, I think the FBI is doing a pretty good job of keeping that information close. But I am seeing on social media, again, Laura Loomer had some very insidious quotes last night, and, a call for even more violence, which is incredibly damaging. But I'm also seeing from the left celebration of this death, and I think both are wrong. And if you're thinking anything other than this is a horrible moment in our nation, I think you need to look in the mirror. This is not. I mean, what Charlie Kirk was saying was many of his positions were atrocious. He was speaking. We have a First Amendment in this country, and we should acknowledge his right to say these things, even as destructive as they could be.
We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I'm interested in, I was reading a piece, and I passed it along to the group last night it was an older piece within the last year, I believe, in the New Yorker about political violence. And I was struck by it because it it is sort of grappling with what we've been talking about of defining it, what it is, and then ultimately how you stop it and you try to and to understand it is one of the keys to curbing it and making sure that it doesn't exist. And it doesn't seem like we're real good at the understanding it part.
You know, you've seen some political leaders from both sides come out last night and say the good things that we need to hear, like this is wrong. We need, and so what we have to watch in the next 12 hours especially is to see when they go off that script and they start to blame the left, you know, or blame somebody. Find out, again, we need to find out who was the assailant, what was involved, was anybody else involved, what were the motivations, and before we do go anywhere. And I think especially in this age of social media, that doesn't happen. I think that's the difference between now and what happened in the 60s when there was this rash of political violence. As the New Yorker article points out, which I was amazed that they could pull that article off so quickly, because they included the references to, I mean, writing is a difficult, time-consuming task, and this article...
I've heard that.
Yes. This article got published very quickly. So to go forward, you need to acknowledge how wrong this is.
And the other thing, too, is that, and this is what I struggle with, the idea of, you know, we need to know more, we need to know where what their background is, what their gripe was, I don't know. I mean, yes, of course, we do need to know that, and we need to put it into a perspective. I understand that. But at the end of the day, a 31-year-old man got up on a college campus and just thank God no students were killed, which is amazing that that didn't happen. And that shouldn't have happened. End of story. I mean, no matter what whatever the background is, whatever the motive was of the individual who pulled the trigger, whatever the motive was of anyone who was in that audience, whatever the motive or the rationale was behind what Charlie Kirk was saying, the fact is someone is dead as a result of what they were saying. And to me, that seems like, okay, that cannot happen.
You know, opposition to campus speakers is not new. I mean, there was substantial opposition to Charlie Kirk talking. And if you remember, Gavin Newsom had Charlie Kirk on as his first guest, and the outrage that followed. But it's never come to this. This, you know, that there was strong opposition to Charlie Kirk speaking, but that's part of the campus conversation, and they let the people come, and that's where college campuses are supposed to be about.
I thought it was interesting. 1,000 people signed a petition that he should be brought to campus, and 6,000 people signed a petition that he shouldn't be. Yeah.
See,
and they brought him in.
And 3,000 showed up to hear him.
That's right.
And debate with him, and some of them agreed with him and some didn't. I was just going to say, you know, I've spent a lot of time in places that are characterized by violence. You know, as I said, I was just in Israel and Palestine last week. I spent a year of my life in a war zone in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm certainly very worried about the temperature in our country right now. Everything we've talked about today, it's truly horrible. But I don't despair, because I think about, for example, the students at the American University of Afghanistan, where I'm on the board, and this university continues to exist and operate, and it has over 1,000 mainly young women studying from inside Afghanistan, and their commitment to their own futures and their belief in the idea that things are going to get better, even in a place like that, is what helps sustain me and think that, you know, we're certainly nowhere near being you know, in a Taliban-dominated society. So we have so many opportunities to come together. We have so much ingenuity, so many resources. We can solve these problems together. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge the horrors that have been happening, but also not despair, because when we despair, that's when we disengage, and disengagement is a form of you know, letting the adversary control the conversation.
Anybody else?
I was just going to go off the idea of you know, welcoming all views to college campuses, which I do. I've gone back and forth on that over the years. I think that it's at the point where the person is actually willing to learn and willing to change, and that's just not the kind of person that Charlie Kirk was. His entire MO was just to yell and to show how he could, you know, debate these people with quote unquote facts and logic. He spewed harmful rhetoric about Muslims, about women, about black people. And these are very damaging ideas, and you've seen the kind of impact that it had on young men in America. You've seen the rise in hatred. And while I do believe that, yes, you know, we need to debate, we need to open our minds, and we can't live in an echo chamber, we have to, you know, acknowledge that these viewpoints exist, but there's a point where it is doing actual harm to have a person like that who is speaking that kind of rhetoric on your campus, and also, you know, just telling blatant lies.
In this case, the you know, the person who was speaking was the one who was gunned down, and I'm just At the risk of repeating myself and what we've been talking about, it strikes me, though, that again, if you're not going to have these debates on a college campus, number one, it seems like that's where you have it. And I remember when it was I don't know how to – Milo Yiannopoulos?
Yes. He was on my campus.
Oh, we're in Cornell?
Ithaca.
Sorry. Damn, so close. And what was the reaction to that?
It was negative. And I remember back then I actually was still battling with that same thing, you know, weighing like this is harmful, this is horrible versus free speech and the need to debate. And I actually don't remember what I settled on back then. But I remember still going back and forth.
But the campus was, I assume many on campus were against it. It was, I think it was Berkeley that actually pulled him, I think, at one point, right? One of the speakers. And I just don't know, that isn't a good look either.
Yeah. I mean, as an administrator at an institution of higher education, you know, I say, like, we fall on the side of free speech and the idea that when controversial speakers come to campus, it's an opportunity for students to engage them in dialogue and confront them. And if a speaker holds views that a student disagrees with, then the student has the opportunity to try to call them to account and get them to answer for it. I think everyone understands that's the general idea. It's supposed to be a learning opportunity, and dialogue is a back and forth, and, you know, it's learning on both sides, and you don't give up the idea that if someone is spewing rhetoric you think is hateful, then maybe you're going to be the one to convince them, right? I mean, I think there's always an element of optimism and idealism in education, that you think, like, you can get the idea across some way. Some new method of explaining it, and we can't give up on that.
We're late for a break. We're going to go over to we're going to get some messages and then go over to the Lockbox studio. WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to get your letters in, we'll continue our conversation after this.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Yes, Thursday morning. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so we're going to change the subject this morning and talk about the 9/11 anniversary. I don't know. There are a couple of things that I thought were interesting to talk about this morning in regards to 9/11. And one of the stories is just something that was said in the days leading up to today's 24th anniversary, and that is Donald Trump talking about wanting to take federal control of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. This from two White House officials amid criticism from some September 11th victims' families over the site's finances and leadership. The officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss private deliberations said the discussions have been preliminary and exploratory, and it was unclear exactly how the federal government would take control of the site in Lower Manhattan. But as a candidate last year, Mr. Trump offered a preview of one potential option, pledging to designate the site of September 11th attacks as a national monument. During a rally last September in Uniondale, New York, he said he wanted to ensure the hallowed ground and the memory of those who perished there will be preserved for all time, preserved forever. The museum's leadership rebuffed the idea at a time when the federal government is working to cut costs. Assuming the full operating expenses for the site makes no sense. According to Beth, or this from Beth Hillman, the president and chief executive of the museum. Mark LaVornia, a spokesman for the museum, also questioned the legal basis for such a takeover. We are certain that there is nothing in existing law that would give the federal government the unilateral ability to take the site over, he said in a statement.
That's a dangerous thing to say.
Well, and I don't know. So the example immediately comes up of the United States Institute of Peace, which is in Washington, D.C., and is an independent or was an independent organization. And somehow the federal government just took it over. This sort of quietly happened earlier this year. I mean, they do receive some funding from the government, but it is an independent private organization. And so this has already happened in another case. And USIP isn't on federal land. I mean, it's got its own private building. So the president is right. He can declare a national monument. I don't know all the details of how that happens. But unlike with a national park, which requires congressional approval, like a national monument can be declared by the president. And that's why we've had more monuments than parks join our Park Service over the past several years. I personally haven't been inside the museum. I hear it's spectacular. It's been highly recommended to me. I just can't quite bring myself to go in there. Like, going to the monument itself has been enough for me. One day I'll go in there. I hear nothing but good things about the museum itself. So I'm not sure what utility, if there's anything other than performative intentions going into what the president is saying about taking over this museum.
One of the things I don't understand quite that, and the example I'm going to use, the comparison I'm going to use, is that of Pearl Harbor. And the site of Pearl Harbor is a national memorial, and is visited by hundreds of thousands of people every year. And I was surprised. I remember being shocked at the time of the creation of the museum and the commission that it was not going to become part of the National Park Service, given the hallowed ground that it is. And so that always surprised me. But now I don't, like you, Malia, I don't quite understand how that even happened in the beginning. That, and I guess it obviously had a lot to do with money,
but also of who controls it and who operates it and who maintains it.
You know, one of the tenets of conservative ideology is small government, and it seems if this goes counter to that. I mean, I haven't been to the museum. I don't really have a strong opinion about whether or not it should be a federal landmark or a national monument. But this whole Donald Trump's approach to like acquiring more and more things just seems counter to everything I know about a conservatism. And doesn't he have other things to do? I mean, there's a whole world of more important issues for him to get involved with. I mean, he's an old man. He take a nap. You don't need to control everything.
Well, I mean, I've been to the site many times. I've been to the site many times, and then I've been in the museum 3 or 4 times. It is a stunning work. It is a dramatic. And it's hard not to come out of there moved and also without I believe, people certainly can disagree with me on this, but a fairly balanced look at what happened on that day. It obviously it's still, even 24 years later, still when it opened, it was still relatively new to all of us in dealing with it. And we're learning more information and finding out more. And all of that seems to be included within the site. But as to taking it over, so I agree with you. I including the nap part. I agree with you, but I do go back to that thing of these places that are part of our country's history.
Flight 93, that site is part of the national, it falls under the purview of the National Park Service. So there's right. logic in what you're saying, but like, it doesn't need to be a hostile takeover, you know?
No. Yeah. No, and I also make a differentiation between the memorial, of the site of the memorial, and the museum.
Mm-hmm.
I think there could be a differentiation made in that as well.
It feels a little bit like stolen valor almost. I mean it seems very shameless, which of course is you know par for the course. I mean, with other things that he's taken over, you can see it as him sort of wanting to spread his agenda and you know put other agendas to the wayside, but I just don't I really don't understand his angle here other than that he wants to take this thing for himself. He wants to take it away, you know, sort of from the people and make it America. And to him now, Donald Trump is synonymous with America. It just feels like he wants that for himself. And I don't know why anyone thought this was a good idea to even start to let happen.
You know, there are conspiracy theories out there still about 9/11, that, yes. And there's a danger that that could be incorporated into that sacred space. There's also, the clear indication he's going to coat everything with some gold leaf.
And, I think actually Laura Loomer is a 9/11 conspiracy theorist, and she's been in his ear. So that doesn't make me very comfortable.
And I do think that they were talking. One of the reasons it was brought up was the money and the groups that were in charge and how all that was going. And I know, and of course you have the victims that are involved and how they were being treated and how what response and what input they had in the running of the space. I mean, there is a lot to juggle there. There's no question about it. But as to who is best to do that, it's interesting to see. But again, I do think that if that decision were to have been made, that it was to be a national monument, that it would have happened a long time ago. The other thing I wanted to talk about in regards to uh, I'm just looking at a letter. Two things. Let me do two quick letters here. These were still letters coming in regarding our last segment on the Charlie Kirk assassination. Patty writes, she was not just a Minnesota lawmaker. Her name was Melissa Hortman. Kirk's name is on everyone's lips, yes. Yet she was killed tragically as well, with little to no acknowledgement from our so-called leaders. No flags ordered at half staff, not a peep. Kirk did not believe in empathy, so I'll send mine to Ms. Hortman's family instead. Melissa Hortman. And then Morgan says, thank you, Joe, and to the panel. This is horrific and a horrendous political killing. I'm hopeful the murderer is caught quickly and stands trial. Following a thorough and transparent investigation, just as Timothy McVeigh was caught and tried. Regardless of the murderer's motive, if the person is killed by law enforcement, vigilante, or by suicide, the spin doctors of both left and right fringe elements will attempt to use Mr. Kirk's killing as rationale for yet more violence. The Utah governor's speech is or was an amazing example of a call to our collective humanity in the face of nearly overwhelming hatred. Thank you for all you do. Thank you very much for your letter.
I'm glad that listener brought up Timothy McVeigh, because I think the Oklahoma City bombing is sort of a similar example of something that those of us who were alive at that time remember very clearly, and it felt like sort of a signal moment in our civic history. And I've been to that museum, also a very, very good museum, but it's privately managed and owned. For whatever reason, that is not part of the National Park Service.
Yeah. Joan writes to us and says that Donald Trump should just leave it alone regarding the 9/11 memorial. Everything he touches goes bad. He and his administration are ruining everything they touch, i.e. the Smithsonian, the Museum for African American, Museum of African American for Slavery, etc. And that from Joan. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll finish up our part of the program. And we'll do that right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Emily Honan, Malia Dumond, and Judy Patrick with us. We have about 10 minutes or so, and we will, as we wrap up this morning, so last call for letters if you want to get in on letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And I thought that one thing I wanted to talk about, too, was the news yesterday. By the way, during the break, Malia told me that Oliver North and Fawn Hall got married. And first of all, I am horribly embarrassed that I didn't know that. Because how did that happen without...
It was a busy news day.
Beeping on my radar.
Apparently, Oliver North's kids didn't know about it either.
Oh. Wow. That is an amazing...
I'm full of all kinds of facts.
Love story.
I don't know if it's a love story or not. We don't know what the motives of these people are either. So.
No, but that is that's an amazing thing. Ms. Hall was Mr. North's secretary on the National Security Council in the 1980s during the secret sales of arms to Iran and the diversion of profits to rebel forces in Nicaragua. And obviously, Oliver North, a decorated former Marine, one-time national security aide in the Reagan administration. Fawn Hall, his former secretary, were married in Virginia last month, 4 decades after they became central figures in the arms for cash scandal known as the Iran-Contra affair. Mr. North, 81, Ms. Hall, 65, were married on August 27th in a civil ceremony in Arlington County that was officiated by Dean Worcester, a retired Virginia district court judge, according to a copy of their marriage certificate, Mr. North and Ms. Hall did not immediately respond to messages left at numbers listed under their names, but the wedding was reported on Substack.
You know, that scandal seems so quaint now, all these years later.
It really does. And what an amazing chapter in that story.
Somebody's going to turn that into an opera.
Yes.
I don't know what else you can do with that story.
Wow. Okay. Former Vice President Kamala Harris has a book out. It's not out yet, but it's coming out. And new copies of the book are being placed in certain hands, and people are writing about it. And in it, former President Kamala Harris said it was a mistake not to question President Joe Biden Jr.'s insistence on running for re-election last year despite his advanced age. In a new book, she writes that it was, quote, recklessness that led her and other Democrats to cede the choice, quote, to an individual's ego. Ms. Harris's assertion places her alongside scores of other figures in the Democratic Party who, since President Trump took office, have publicly admitted that Mr. Biden's reelection effort at age 81 was a mistake, long before Mr. Biden's disastrous debate performance against Mr. Trump in June of 2024, Democrats had privately questioned whether he should run again. During all those months of growing panic, should I have told Joe to consider not running? Perhaps, she wrote in an excerpt from her forthcoming book, 107 Days, published on Wednesday in The Atlantic. But the American people had chosen him before in the same matchup. Maybe he was right to believe that they would do so again. The former vice president described herself as in the worst position to make the case that he should drop out of the 2024 race because she believed Mr. Biden would view such a move as disloyal. It's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, I agree.
First
of all, I just want to say I don't think age was the issue. I mean, my great-grandmother was very feisty and fully intellectually capable until, you know, over the age of 100. So it's you know, people of different ages have different capacities.
And Oliver North is also 81.
So
and living a whole new life, a new wife.
Right. So I'm sure, you know, ego clearly was part of it, but I also think this is part of the power of incumbency in this country, that it's, Joe Biden was in somewhat of a bubble, and part of it was his own making, but part of it is how our system has evolved, and who is really speaking truth to power. I mean, Kamala Harris, for very good reasons, felt like she couldn't do it. I mean, who else is going to do it? And I think we all know now that it came down to his family prevailing upon him, but that's after the public debate had already developed to a really damaging degree. You know, and so I think it's very difficult for leaders in those kind of positions, if they are isolated, as he clearly was. And again, I think that's kind of how our system protects the president in a way. But protecting the president isn't always helpful if their faculties are starting to fail, you know. And I think it's very difficult to fix that. But I wouldn't ascribe all of it to his ego, is what I'm saying.
I agree. I think it's a combination of a bunch of different things. And I also agree. I mean, what are you supposed to say to the president of the United States? Like, I think you should step down. I mean, who is going to say that? I mean, let alone Kamala Harris. I mean, I think that they really did her dirty in that election. I think that it was a mistake. I guess Democrats must have underestimated or overestimated how popular Biden really was with the people. I mean, 2020, I remember being very surprised in 2020 that he did win. But I think that if they'd managed to put up Kamala just a little bit earlier, I think that she would have had a real chance. But unfortunately, he hung on for way too long, way past, I'm sure, many, many people, as is being revealed now.
The book is titled 107 Days, and that's how many days she had to run an entire campaign that's usually done over a course of a billion years, which actually is only about 7 or 8, but still it seems like a billion.
She's more candid than I expected her to be in this book.
Yes, I agree.
And we should note that her protective detail has been taken away from her by the president, by President Trump, just as she embarks on this book tour. And given the rise in political violence, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. That being said, she wants a political future, and she needed to get out there and have expressed some distance between herself and Biden. But she's still straddling the line too much. She says, perhaps I should have said something. Well, maybe get rid of the word perhaps. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was one of her problems, is she was trying to be too deferential to Biden, and I think she's still doing that to some extent.
Yeah.
And Joe, do you have your copy of the book yet?
I do not. I was not on the initial list. Mm-hmm. I will say that one of the things that struck me, however, or struck me then, strikes me now, and I think this was something that was regularly pointed out in the Jake Tapper book about Biden's state after the from the. The moment of the disastrous debate to the decision to finally leave the race, was that they were really good at hiding it. The entire team was really good at keeping him under wraps and knowing what the best times of day were. I know I make that sound more sinister than I mean it to be. And I think the best reading of it is that they were trying to put him in the best light for the presidency, and that some people perhaps could have missed some of the signs that were there.
I think there was also some magical thinking going on. In
absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. And it doesn't absolve them from looking at it, because it also seems that a lot of people, when they were leaving the room, would look at each other going, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
But she did say that Biden on his worst day was far better than Trump on his best day.
Well, how do you prove that? You know?
Right. And again, she's on a tour. What her political future is uncertain. I think she was given put in a terrible position, especially that month that we waited for Biden to make a decision after the debate performance. I mean, that was 30 days that she'll never, you know, she should have had that she didn't get. I mean, she stumbled in her own presidential campaign as well, you know, and I don't think she was treated well by the administration while she was vice president. I think she was marginalized. I think she was given a really bad, what they call portfolio, given, you know, immigration to handle. I mean, that was like, give me something else. I think she should have spoken up and said, you know, this is a dog of an issue. Or maybe she should have stepped up sooner and said, we need to do more on immigration. So it was a bad situation for her all around.
And we'll see what more comes out in the book about different aspects of it. But it is fascinating to sort of see where she was at that moment. I don't know. Should I say this out loud? I don't know how sorry I feel for her yet. Does that mean, like, I don't know how, like, I want to, but then I don't know.
You know, some political pundits said that no one could have beaten Trump, that she did the best she could have, and that...
And given that time period, yeah. I mean, given that
or
extremely...
Even earlier.
I'm not sure that if she'd had more time, if it would have turned out better. I think she did the best she could have with the time that was given, and I think Trump was probably going to win anyway.
And what is also is, I think we could agree. I mean, I don't think that, by all accounts, especially given that we live while he was president. Joe Biden did fill out his entire time as president. there was no indication that that situation would have improved or that he would have been a vital candidate on the campaign trail to a point of winning political office. But we never know, do we? We just guess these things. We're going to call it there. My thanks to Emily Honan, Malia Dumont, and Judy Patrick. Thank you all for being here. We are going to take a break, and we will be back with some Lockbox Love as well right after this.